Well, first of all, let me thank you for taking the time to be here, and I'm very glad to have been invited by my old friend Will for this presentation. Since we don't have much time, I'll just go into it right away, with your permission. What I do here is to look at the role of association football or soccer. I used the word football because in Newfoundland, a lot of people still use it, and I, having been born in Italy, I still refer to it as football. I will be looking at the role of football, association football, in the development of a Newfoundland identity in the last part of the 19th century. So my argument, to summarize it, is that football in Newfoundland, and primarily in St. John's, because we will be talking about St. John's, only the capital. Football does spread to the rest of the island, but only at the beginning of the next century. So football both reflects and plays a role in the development of a national identity in Newfoundland in the late 19th century. And it can be used the same way some have done with music, to track the evolution of this identity. Now, when we talk about a Newfoundland national identity, we're not really talking about nationalism understood in its political meaning of a group of people who feel they have something in common and they wish to basically be independent and self-governing. So some historians usually use the term colonial identity or patriotic nativism to refer to nationalism in Newfoundland, because it was always nationalism within an imperial context. So it was a sacred identity in a sense. The process begins in 1815 with the reivindications for representative government, led by a Scot, William Carson, who was a physician, and an Irishman, Patrick Morris, who was a merchant. Newfoundland historians have described their reivindication as an expression of the political self-assertion of the British middle classes who happened to live in Newfoundland. And this is largely true because it echoed what was going on back home. But their central idea, and their central idea, which wasn't even theirs because they borrowed it from somebody else, but nevertheless they spread it, was that the potential of the hardy Newfoundlanders was being undermined by outside forces, meaning basically Great Britain. And so this idea takes root and develops. And without giving you the executive summary of the political developments, nevertheless, there are some moments which I want to bring out. In 1832, they finally obtain representative government, which is basically slightly different from what we call responsible government, because the National Assembly, which is elected, it's only consulted, so it's not a decision-making body. The achievement of representative government creates a period of turmoil in Newfoundland because it basically brings to the fore a number of overlapping cleavages between the executive council that makes the decision and which is largely conservative, Protestant and made up of expatriates from Great Britain, and the representative assembly, which is largely Catholic, Irish, and made not exclusively, but made up of natives, people who were born in Newfoundland. So there is a period of turmoil until basically 1855. During this period, there is also the birth in Newfoundland of a number of ethnic societies. The St. Andrew's Society, which was obviously Scottish, the Benevolent Irish Society, and also of an English society, which are largely dining club cum benefit to their groups. One of the society that is born in, well, is founded in 1836 is called the Native Society. And what is interesting about it is that, first of all, to be a member, you have to be born in Newfoundland. And second, they have a political program, which is basically that of promoting the role of native Newfoundlanders to the political aspects of the administration of the colony. All of this comes to an end in 1855 with the responsible government, which basically establishes in Newfoundland the kind of what political scientists call consociational society. That is to say, basically, the elites of the different ethnic groups make arrangements, reach compromises among themselves, which then they sell to their respective groups in society. But the seeds of this island identity, colonial identity, are there, and you know they basically are reinforced by a number of events that take place later. 1857, for instance, the crisis over the so-called French shore. The French had maintained fishing rights on the west part of the island since the Treaty of Utrecht. In 1857, the British tried to clarify exactly what was meant in that treaty, and they reached a pretty reasonable agreement with the French, but the Newfoundlanders saw it as basically another example of their perennial being victimized by imperial politics. And then in the 1860s, the debate over confederation, which again saw a majority of natives opposing confederation with their other colonies, and the majority of the other that were in favor. So sources for my history of football, I came across this letter, which is from 1879, which I think gives you a pretty good idea of the status of how Newfoundlanders felt at the time. This is a letter to the local paper by somebody who signs himself Loyalty, and who basically complains that when the national anthem, meaning God Save the Queen, is played at official occasions, people stand up and leave before it has been played out. And he ends his letter by saying, "I should not be surprised if in less than 10 years from now, gentlemen, will put on their hats and prepare to leave the churches while the benediction is being pronounced." So it seems that, you know, by this time already, people do not care much about the mother country. So let's see how football fits in this evolution and brings it to the First World War. Football arrives in Newfoundland. Association football arrives in Newfoundland early. Actually, only in South Africa and India arrives a couple of years earlier than in Newfoundland. And that's not surprising because of the almost daily communication that existed between the island and England. So the first club of which I found a record was called the Terra Nova Club, and it was the club of a foundry, an industrial foundry owned by a Scot, Mr. Gemmell, so much so that the Terra Nova Club was also called, referred to as the Gemmell's Man. I found the report of some of their games, but Higgins, who was later the secretary of the league, wrote in 1901, "The Terra Nova players were a strong combine and were victorious in most of their matches, chiefly against men from the various warships that visited the port." But there were also other teams in town. So one was the Cathedral Works, and this was exclusively an English team made up of people who were building the Anglican Cathedral at the time. And they played a few games, they set up a club and played a few games against other local teams. The Victoria Rangers was another interesting team because it was also linked to an industrial combine, another foundry. And it was largely English, and it was on the west end of the harbour. The Scots were on the east end, so there was this kind of rivalry. And the third one was a club called Natives. And the Natives, to be a member of this club, you had to be Newfoundland born. And It could be said that what, although the natives were not associated with the native society that that I mentioned earlier, because by this time that society had disappeared, nevertheless, they can be said to have continued the struggle of the native society, which wished to give a chance to Newfoundlanders to reach the highest echelons of public life and apply this message to football, which is not surprising because at the beginning, no matter where you go in the world, the first clubs were set up by the British, and they did not really accept new members for a while. And eventually, you know, they accepted locals, but at the beginning, you know, they were reluctant. So, for instance, recently I was looking at the lineup of the team that in Italy won the first championship in 1899. 7 were British, 2 were Swiss, and there were only 2 Italians. So here, 30 years earlier, was not very different. And the natives obviously were not very good because I found records of 3 games they played against Terranova and they were defeated 9-0, 2-0, and 4-0. And so that might explain why they might have found it difficult to play for the other established club and being obliged to set up their own. But there was also there is also evidence of, you know, tensions between the locals and the visiting teams. So, for instance, in 85, I found a record of this game between the Victoria Rangers and the sailors of this Navy ship. And the local paper commented by saying the Tars, meaning the sailors, got the ball easily into 2 goals. And, in fact, it is stated that there were 2 of their number, one being the captain, who alone could have held their own against the combined strength of their opponents, the local team. And so this reader basically sent a letter in which he said, oh, that's nonsense, you know, at least 5 of our players would beat the captain, and then, you know, went on to blame the referee, the timekeeper, because he had apparently robbed them of 15 minutes at the end. This is a picture of, this is the very first picture of football in Newfoundland. It's in Kidivili. I've come across 3 versions of this picture, and everybody says something different. One of them, for instance, says it was 1910, which is wrong, because by 1910 they no longer played in this field. And I believe that this is either the Terranova or Victoria Rangers or the natives playing at Kidivili, and you can see that it's almost difficult to recognize that this is a football team, but football was played at the very beginning in a different way than we were used to today. If I had more time, I could give you some indications of why this is football and not something else. This is the field, although this is taken much later. This is when it was taken over by the Newfoundland Regiment in the First World War, and they basically trained there before going off to war. In the late 1880s, football declines in favor of rugby. Although it must be said that at this time, and it was the same in England, the distinction between rugby and football, although established in 1863, took 20 years to really go apart. So it was not uncommon, for instance, for clubs or teams of the sailors to put an ad in the paper saying, we'll play against any combine, any team in town, rugby or football rules, association or rugby rules, and even half the time rugby rules, half the time association rules. So it was common for the teams, and actually both of the clubs played cricket, played rugby, and played football. But nevertheless, there is very little about football during this period. But then in the 1890s, something important happens, which is important even today. The schools begin to play football, the denominational schools, Bishop Field, CEI, and this leads in time to the formation on the English model back in the mother country of the old Fieldians, in other words, people who have moved on but nevertheless continue to play, and they regroup. But there is also a team that is formed, actually it's not a team, it's not a club, it's a series of games between aliens, in other words, people born in the British Islands living in St. John's, against natives. In other words, representatives of locals. So I found the two games that were played in 1894, just a month apart, in which the aliens, not surprisingly, prevail 2-1 and 1-0. And this had happened also some years earlier, 20 years earlier, 24 years earlier, concerning cricket, aliens versus natives. In cricket, though, the natives had prevailed 113 to 111. And also it's common during this period for Royal Navy ships to meet not local clubs, but city-selected teams. Concerning these two games with the aliens versus natives, the local paper went out of its way to underline that it was all very friendly, which leads me to suppose that probably wasn't. So there was no rough play and good feeling prevailed, it was said about the first game. The second one, this evening there will be national strength brought to bear against our little colony. Aliens will kick at football against natives in friendly rivalry. There will be boys from the land of the heather and the land of the rose, but even so a hard-fought battle is anticipated. Last evening, a big effort was made for mastery of football between aliens and natives, all bearing kindly feelings to one to the other. The distinguishing name being rather a stimulus to action and interest than to in any way create any feeling whatever approaching hostility. Natives have improved vastly as a team since their last game. All around, there was almost marvelous individual kicking, but a lack of combination. In 1896, a football league is established. One of the very first. In Italy, for instance, the league is established in 1899. And you can see from the list that basically the denominational aspect was very important. St. Andrew was a Scottish club. CEI stands for Church of England Institute. Knowling was a Scottish department store. Rovers, I haven't yet been able to find anything. Star of the Sea was the largest Catholic club in St. John's, having almost 3,000 members. Church-led brigades was Anglican, and the Institute was the Methodist Institute. So denominational and ethnic divisions. The next year, however, and this is where they played the first year, Low Island Grounds, which was part of the Fieldians, which was an Anglican school. The league was won by the British, by St. Andrew, the Scottish. And the guy in the middle with the ball is Peter Marr, and he won a contest as the most loved player. He was a prolific goal scorer because a local store was starting to sell candies, and the paper of the candies was a ballot, and you could just write who was your favorite player, and he won hands-on as the most loved player. In the second year of the league, a club was formed called the Terranova Football Club. The paper reported that a new club has just been organized. Its members are of every denomination, which at the time, and even 30 years ago in Newfoundland, would have been unthinkable almost. The only qualification being that each member must be a born Newfoundlander. Its first meeting and so on. Some of the players that played for that year, the captain, and the captain at the time was very important because it was not only a player, but it was also the guy that decided what to do on the field, was George B. Ayer, who was born in St. John's and went on, actually, to an illustrious career and is in Newfoundland Sports of Fame as a builder. And there were these two brothers who were probably the most famous athletes in St. John's at the beginning of the century, the Vinicomb, who played every sport possible. They won at hockey, rugby, and also Andrew Carnell, that went on to become a mayor of the city later on. It's also important to notice that in 1897, the second year, the league mandated that the team had to have official colors so that they wouldn't go on the field and everybody had a different shirt. And so the Terranova chose black jerseys, black shorts or knickers, as they said at the time, and black stockings with a white top. But, and that's the important qualification, the club intends adopting the colors proposed by Mr. Howley, a bishop, for Newfoundland, pink, white, and green. Today, if you go to Newfoundland, you will find this flag, which is linked to independence, everywhere. Most people think that the pink is a kind of a faded red, but it isn't, it's pink. And this was basically an elaboration of the flag of the native society of the 1840s, which they basically put on their shirt. They finished fourth out of eight with a 4-2-2 record, and the Saints, the Scots, won again. But the paper reported that the Evening Telegram said that Terra Nova was one of the most popular clubs in the league. In the game versus Star of the Sea, which was also very strong, in September, in spite of the disagreeable condition of the weather, all the available space on the spectator stands was occupied. Not unusual to have 2,000 spectators, and the top was 4,000. Now, if you consider that St. John's at the time had 28,000 people, this is an important number. And I was lucky enough last Friday to come across this postcard, which is in a collection on Stratford-upon-Avon. And this is St. George's Field, where the league played at the time. And you see, I haven't counted how many people there are there, but there are certainly a couple of thousand. And when I looked at this picture, it reminded me of a famous painter, Lowry, that painted soccer pitches as well. And so I just put this one here. Of course, in St. John's, you don't have chimneys with smoke, but, you know, there is a kind of resemblance. And, of course, you know, the players left very often to go to study in England or to go and work somewhere. And the local paper always followed them. So, for instance, this guy, Edward Reed, who had played in 1896 for the Church of England, went to study at Oxford, and he was selected to play in a freshman game, which was probably not very important. But the paper gave him you know, this guy from Newfoundland, where soccer has just arrived, is playing with the guys from the famous English public schools, and it ends the article by saying, Flora Terra Nova, you know, let the Newfoundlanders flourish. And so, you know, you see this. And this is the guy here, the first on the left, the Reed, who went to Oxford. In the 1898 season, Terra Nova, the club is basically playing for the second season, but you see that it really goes down. A lot of the players have left. The captain, one of the Vinicombe, and Andrew Carnell have gone the denominational way. It's nothing surprising. Even in the second year, you can see that there is a difference between the three top teams and the others. And so the three top teams basically take the players from the other teams and become even better. And so Terra Nova basically had lost three of his best players. And then they disappear. And here you see the captain, Ayer, in the center and the back, and Andrew Carnell on the extreme left, seated, who are playing with the Church of England Institute the following year. However, and I'm finishing, after 2 years, the Terra Nova Club was gone from the football scene, but it was replaced by another one, I haven't done much research on this yet, called Cabot. And Cabot, I have the feeling that it was another nationalist club, because the previous year, 1897, there had been the celebration of Queen Victoria, which was mixed with the celebration for the 400th year of discovery of Newfoundland by Cabot. And there was a big discussion on the organizing committee not wanting to join the two. So this Cabot name, I have the feeling that, you know, was again a nativist club. But the name Terra Nova was resurrected in the Football League in 1916 for a team made up of players from Church of England Institute, Fields, and Star of the Sea, which did not participate in the league that year because most of their players had volunteered and enlisted in the Newfoundland Regiment. So those left over participated together, interdenominational, and they resurrected the name of Terra Nova, which was the very first one. I stop here because I probably have gone over time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Croce. And maintenant, on va passer aux questions. On peut demander des questions en anglais ou en français. Est-ce qu'il y a des questions? Do we have a question from the floor right there?
You suggested that football was a vehicle which allowed Newfoundland to cut across many of the divisions, such as class, language, religion, etc. Could this be transferred then to other things like politics or the army or any other aspect as a result of
Yes, you're right in saying that I suggested that. I suggested that it both reflects the divisions that exist, but it also tries to transcend them. So it tracks the evolution of an identity. Now, your question is an interesting one. I wouldn't want to make football appear to be more important than it is, but they, at least the clubs that I mentioned, try to transcend those divisions in the name of the sport. I don't think that within the Newfoundland Regiment, and I've read quite a few things about it, the nomination was really that important, because the fact of living the same dangers and living together probably transcended that. So if what you're asking me, how important has football been in this respect, it has not transcended the divisions, because when I went to Newfoundland in 1991, and I played in the old-timers teams, they were still along the denominational lines, and I, born a Catholic, although not religious in any way, ended up playing for the two Anglican teams. But even if in the Fildians, half of us were Catholic, it was not uncommon when we played Holy Cross to hear a lot of jokes about Catholic Irish, so it has remained, although, you know, it was while you were drinking beer in the dressing rooms. And today, if the denominational aspects have been overcome, has been primarily because in 1994 the denominational schools were eliminated. But when I first went there, it was not uncommon for people to I would ask somebody, do you know that person? They would say, no, same age, but he went to the other school.
Another question? Go ahead.
You were talking about Lawrence Maine there?
Yes.
You mentioned something about the smoke coming out of the chimneys. It wasn't there. So.
Well, I said the only difference between the picture of St. George's Field in St. John's and Lowry's picture, which I probably was in Salford or Manchester, is that in the picture of Lowry there are the chimneys in the background, whereas in St. John's there were no chimneys, and there are no chimneys today either, for that matter.
Any other questions? All right, perfect. Well, thank you very much, Professor Croce.